That being said,
if you can get everyone in your neighborhood involved, you make your whole neighborhood a much harder target in general, and that benefits everyone. So there's a community aspect to it too, but you know, fix your own house first. So we'll get into it. The first thing you want to look at is, what do people see when they're driving by, jogging by, or whatever it is? Does what people see instantly tell them something about your security posture? Does that make you an easier target? Is it a harder target? Is it going to be something that someone with ill intent sort of gets their interest and then they start looking further? Or is it something that they instantly go, well, that's too hard. Two doors down, it's going to be a lot easier pickings. So looking at what's visible, what cars are in the driveway. If someone's jogging a neighborhood, which is a common casing tactic, and they see, you know, two BMWs that are, you know, 2 years old in the driveway, they're going to look at that a lot differently than the house three doors down that has a 10-year-old Corolla. The person with the BMWs probably has more disposable income, more expensive things in their house, so that can make you a target. Keeping cars in the garage is one way to mitigate that, but just being cognizant of what's visible is helpful. Security system signs and decals, even if you don't have a security system, can have a positive effect. They're not an end-all be-all, but it's a positive thing to have. Having a beware of dog sign, or a large dog bowl, even if you don't have a dog, not everyone knows you don't have a dog. So that's a tactic used by some people to try to deter. If someone's coming up and knocking on your door, and they see a massive dog bowl that says Brutus on it, they may notice that if they're casing your place and knocking on doors, looking for signatures for a petition, or, you know, handing out things, soliciting is also a common tactic people use to case places. Can people see inside your house easy? Like, are your blinds open? Can someone just peek through your porch and see what kind of TV you have? You probably shouldn't do that, especially at night, because, you know, people can see in and you can't see them. Is there easy concealment near your doors and windows? I mean, landscaping's a nice thing, but having a really tall tree right outside your back door is not a good idea. It's an easy thing for someone to hide behind and either cause harm to you without you knowing that they were there, or to work behind on getting through a door, picking a lock, breaking a window, without your neighbors being less likely to notice. And another semi-related point is the access to your utility connections easy. A lot of people that have security systems, those systems will call out on a landline. Criminals know this and will cut your landline. So unless you've paid the extra for a LTE backup, a cellular backup on your system can complain very loudly, but it's not calling anyone for help if they're able to cut that. They could also cut your power too, but they're in for a ride if they do that. Talking about your front door, this is the thing people are going to look at most when they're coming up to your house. Having glass in your door handle is not the greatest. It's pretty easy to break and reach through and undo your deadbolt. And a criminal doesn't mind breaking your windows. It's obvious if people can see it from the road, but again, if you have like a recessed front door where there's not good visibility, the lights are dim at night, you have, you know, topiary up the sides, it's a lot of room to work. People won't notice. Your neighbors won't see, oh yeah, their side window's busted out and the door's hanging open or something like that. So consider that. That's something that, you know, maybe you're kind of stuck with the door, but next time you're doing home improvement, think about what front door you have. Are your locks old and worn? Older locks have less deterrence to people who are able to pick locks. And the more worn a lock is in general, the easier it is to pick. Does your front door have a deadbolt? Or any exterior door, for that matter. Because it doesn't really matter which door they pick, as long as they can get in, they're in. I would highly strongly recommend a good deadbolt. One thing that most people don't have to worry about, but are your hinges on the outside of the house? Because if they are, it's really easy to pull those hinge pins out and just pull the door out. It's not hard, and there are tools specifically designed to do it, but a screwdriver and ball peen hammer are excellent. Does your door fit well in its frame, or could someone stick a credit card in and undo your latch that way? And those are things that front doors usually do a pretty good job at, but maybe the side garage door or the basement door needs a little bit of attention on. If someone's able to get up to your house and actually look around, they're likely to be able to find an easier way in than their front door. Good secure strike plates are fairly inexpensive. That's what this middle picture is here. You'll notice this is sort of a standard latch strike plate, and this is a big chunk of steel. I will tell you from personal experience, it is very difficult and quite exhausting to kick in someone's door when they have a good deadbolt on. It takes a long time. It's really annoying. You're mad by the time you've gotten in. It's not a fun experience. It was legal. Police were already involved. But yes, I have kicked in a door, and yes, the deadbolt was very, very effective. So use good deadbolts. And the last thing on doors is have a way to communicate without necessarily unlocking and opening your door. Ring doorbells are a great option for that. They have some other security concerns we'll get to later on the cyber side. But generally, it gives you a leg up. Any way that you can have you know, put out a peephole or maybe a security door, you'll see houses in lower income areas will have this big, what looks like a cage door on their screen door, and then also a good door inside. Well, the reason they do that is they can open up their door and keep this big iron cage in front of them so that if someone's trying to bust in, they can't. So having a way to communicate, know who's at the other side of their door, hopefully what's in their hands as they're walking up to the door, and the ring doorbells and similar concepts are a great tool for that, because it usually captures someone walking up to your door, usually before they know that they're on camera, even if you have an audio alert on there. So you get a little bit better situational awareness on what's on the other side of your door. Obviously, if someone doesn't go through the door, they're going through the window. So considering what other ways of getting into your property or getting into your house itself, what are ways? Obviously, with this fence here, you could jump over the fence, but it's really obvious that you're jumping over a fence. So if you're in a neighborhood that looks really weird to someone who's paying attention, it's also a pain to try to take things back over that fence. So making things hard for someone to steal your big TV is a good thing. So fence gates, we recommend having an actual lock on. Same thing with the garage door, have some way that's actually secured. There are ways, if it's an older garage door, to blast an IR signal and get it to open. So a lot of the newer systems don't allow for that sort of attack. So maybe think about upgrading the garage door, but again, there's a lot of other simpler things that I would do before going to that point. And then windows and window wells, having, sort of going back to earlier, don't have big bushes by your windows, so it makes it easier for something to work on. Window wells especially, it's already ready concealment. If I want to get in through a window, one, the storage room in the basement that no one ever goes in is probably a really great unsecure way to get in, where I could steal things and no one would notice for a month, or I could really take my time on getting through that window and have a great exfil option that most people aren't ever going to notice. So window wells are a required feature by code in a lot of cases, but also present a really unique security risk. Outbuildings and yards, knowing what's around your house is important. A lot of people have sheds. What do you normally keep in your shed? You've got a lawnmower, it's a couple $1,000. You've got a bunch of tools. You've got landscaping equipment, your weed whacker, all that stuff. All of that is two things to a thief. One, easy to steal and easy to fence. And two, you've also just given them the tools to break your windows in. So consider what of value is in your outbuilding, what it would cost you to replace that, and secure those buildings according to that actual risk. Lighting is really, I would say, my number one recommendation. You can go on Amazon, as much as I just like them, and buy very inexpensively solar-powered motion-activated lights. You set them up, you forget about them, and they turn on when someone walks by all the time. Putting that everywhere around your property, so one, if you hear a bump in the night, you can look outside and see which light is on. That's really good for situational awareness. And two, anyone who's trying to approach your house is automatically gained from light. Darkness flees from the light. That includes thieves. Concealment, similar to the landscaping, but I'm talking in this case more about, do you have like maybe a wood line behind your house? And do your lights go all the way out to that wood line? Or is there this no man's land where you can really do whatever you want and no one's really ever going to notice someone running back and forth through that area or standing there for an hour watching your bedtime routine to see what gets turned off, what doesn't get locked, and really casing your abode. Tools we kind of already discussed. Ladders. If you store a ladder in an unsecure place outside your house, lock your upstairs windows because you just gave someone a way to get to them. I see lots of people putting ladders on fences, which seems like a great efficient way to store it. But at least chain it up with a lock. Don't bungee cord it on there because you've given people access to anywhere that ladder can reach by having that ladder accessible. If someone does get inside, because someone persistent enough can, it's good to think about what you have inside. Everyone usually thinks of, well, what are my self-defense options? And that is the correct way to think. But are you always near those self-defense options? Because if you don't control them, someone else can control them. Those without kids may maybe keep a gun on their nightstand. If you're not home, is that gun still on your nightstand? Because it's, again, stealable, fenceable. But also, if you come home at the wrong time, it could be used against you. So securing things still in a way that's easier to get to, but a way that's not just lying out for someone if they get the jump on you, is something to be cognizant of. The location and storage valuables. I mean, everyone has that the document fire safe that they probably keep other things than documents in from Walmart. And most people throw it under the master bed. Almost everyone does this. So this is one of the first places, and I'm guilty of this too. I used to do that until I went, oh, everyone does that. Maybe I should stop doing that. It's one of the first places a thief will look, is you go to the master bedroom, that's where the jewelry is, that's where the firearms are, that's where the important documents are. You know, someone comes in and steals all your tax records, they've got your identity. I mean, that you don't think that's a valuable target necessarily, and it's not easily fenceable, but someone more sophisticated can come in and steal those kind of documents and wait until next tax season when you're not thinking about the burglary you had in March, and really wreak some havoc on you if you haven't secured that and then reported what was stolen and taken some other proactive steps. One thing some people use is diversion safes and other containers. So you could take that document storage safe and put it in your pantry and put a food box that's empty over top of it so that it looks like kibbles and bits. And no one's going to steal your kibbles and bits. Or even probably bother, because the pantry is really boring when you're looking for stealable, fenceable items. You can go, again, on Amazon, because it's the catalog of the everything, and find all sorts of diversion containers, you know, shaving cream, Coca-Cola, water bottles, a box of whatever, that are designed with hidden compartments in them that most people would not even give a second thought to. And you can stash, you know, thumb drives, all that stuff in there. They're typically not fireproof, so that's a consideration if that's one of the threats you're trying to mitigate. But there are ways you can hide things. The example here on the screen is a book with the insides hollowed out that you can put some valuables in, stick it on your bookshelf. Most thieves are not going to empty all of your books. They don't have time to do that unless you've posted that you're in the Bahamas for the next 3 weeks and aren't coming back. In which case, yeah, they can clean you out. And they'll probably find those things if they have that time and they know they have it. Here's a great example of a house that is basically impervious, but you don't really need to go to that level. This was on the internet listed as a zombie-proof house. I questioned their security assessment and what kind of threats they're trying to mitigate. Unless you really do believe in zombies, I think they've gone a little overboard. But they're using a lot of good techniques here. So motion-activated solar lights. Security cameras are a great option. Place them out of reach because they're also stealable. And the first thing someone sees with a camera that they can see is, well, I've got to take that out before I can do the rest of my action. So having it in an inaccessible place is beneficial. A working security system is a great idea. Good locks on your doors, thorny bushes in your utilities, or camera intercom, kind of most of the stuff we've already gone into. This is the wrap up. The other thing I didn't mention yet is a driveway sensor. If you are in a more rural area, you probably aren't relying on neighbors as much to see what's going on, but you may have a really long driveway. And if you're able to put a sensor down at the beginning of that driveway and give yourself a lot of warning when someone's coming up, it gives you a better situational awareness of what's coming onto your property before someone's at your front door. And gives you time to prepare and at least know that someone's in the area. Moving on to digital security. This is the thing that so many people overlook or maybe don't know how to do. I don't work professionally in this field, but I've been studying it for about the last 8 years and working to make my stuff a lot more secure. It works on a similar concept. You don't necessarily have to be in the digital Fort Knox, but if you're two or three steps more secure than 99% of the general population is, because most people are not, then you're the hard target and people will just move on to someone else because there's plenty of other fish. Some of the things to look at are your digital footprint. What digital threats are you likely individually to experience? And that's somewhat of a case-by-case basis. What are your digital valuables? What's important to be securing that exists in cyberspace? And what are some tools we can use to secure those items? So digital footprint is everything that you do online. It is a trail of crumbs that follows everything from the time you log in to Google, please don't, to everywhere you browse on the internet. It's all your online accounts, every subscription service or email subscription you have, all of your social media posts for all of time, even if you deleted them, all the tracking cookies, every cookie on your browser that tracks what websites you go to and reports back to sometimes Facebook or other advertisers, all the online shopping, everything you've ever bought online, your shopping rewards. So when you go to Kroger or Food Lion and you type your phone number in, that links back to an online account and their system tells them what you buy when you buy it. There's a high-profile case regarding just that from Target about 10 years ago, so this has been going on a while, where a family started receiving targeted ads from Target. And what they would do, they'd give you their general, these are our sales, but then that last page would be, here's things that we think you're interested in. And that was based off of your individual buying habits of the last month or 2 months or 3 months, however long they were looking, and an algorithm going, well, this is the things this person's interested in, let's give them a few coupons so they're more likely to go to Target, which is an excellent advertising strategy. So when this family started receiving ads for diapers and baby formula and all this stuff, and their oldest child, I think, was 16, and this father was not happy that Target was sending in his daughter's name these ads saying, oh, you want to have a baby, don't you? He's like, no, she's 16, we don't need to be doing this. So he went and complained to Target and actually started to sue them. And Target looked into this and went, oh, well, it's because our algorithm saw what else she was buying and none of it was pregnancy related, but it triggered something in the algorithm. And I see someone nodding over here, they know what I'm talking about. And it went, ah, this person must be pregnant. Well, 3 weeks later, they found out that this 16-year-old was pregnant, and Target figured it out before anyone else did, just because you typed your number in. So that's the level, and again, this was 10 years ago. They've gotten better. That's the level of invasiveness that companies are willing to go to. I won't necessarily say behind your back, because it's all in the terms of service that we read and agreed to. the biggest lie on the internet. But it's so very everywhere that it's hard to avoid, but it's good to be aware of. Your search history, and that goes beyond just, you put your browser in incognito mode, and your browser probably, although there have been lawsuits about this too, probably won't track your browsing habits. But your internet service provider still sees all of that traffic, and it's 100% legal for them to log all of that and to sell that to advertisers. So even though you're paying them for a service, you're still their product. They do that. Why would they not do that? Online banking is a more secure Netscape than some of these other things, but it's also very high risk. Your habits of which bank you go to are known by your ISP, by whichever browser is tracking your cookies and all that stuff. So that information can be bought on a very targeted individual level, relatively inexpensively. And we're talking like less than $50. For someone's advertising profile, and someone could then craft phishing emails that look like they're from your bank. And if they know enough about your other habits, could say, hey, your recent purchase for this was declined because there was an invasion to your account. Log in here and let's fix it. But when you type your password and stuff in, you've just given that to the thieves. Yes, absolutely.
And my daughter said, this is great, mm-hmm. said, look at, pull down who sends it,
yes.
their email
yes.
address. And it's from a Gmail account. Anyone can create a
yep.
Gmail account. So there are ways of being more savvy. So
yes.
I just become more and more sensitive. I don't trust anything sent to me.
Not
anyone. I just become very, very suspect. So that was just one thing.
And unfortunately, that's a very healthy level of paranoia. I know I get phishing phone calls all the time, and usually they're the very obvious, we've been trying to reach you about your car's extended warranty. Yeah, no thanks. But sometimes they're well crafted, and there have been several that I've started to go, oh, hold up, this doesn't make sense, and look deeper into it. But your first reaction is to go, oh, well, that's interesting. Let me log in and check. If you get an email that you think might be real but you're not sure, do not click the links in that email. Go to the website and log in as you normally would and check with them, or call that service on a publicly listed number, not necessarily the number in that email. So, you know, some things are real and you do need to take action on. And I have had some from my internet service provider that were real, but were so unexpected that I didn't believe them. But fortunately, on the internet, we can usually find the actual website and the right, you know, customer service number to call. But it does take a certain level of paranoia and cognizance in that moment to not just go, oh, here's the number they gave me, I'll just click that on my phone and call them. It's super easy, but it's not the most secure option. So that's a great segue into our digital threats. Data collection, we've kind of already covered. Identity theft, you know, if you're filing your taxes online, be sure that what you're doing is a secure method. An easy tip, if you look at the top where the website you're visiting is, there should be a green, typically green, padlock symbol next to it. That is for HTTPS. The S stands for security. It means your traffic is encrypted from your device to their servers. So if someone is watching your web traffic, they can see what website you're visiting, but they can't see the content of what you're interacting with on that website. So especially if you're going to a banking website or what you think is a banking website, check and make sure that that's there. And most modern browsers will give you an alert if that's not the case, and are getting better at being proactive and letting you know things. But it's always good, if you're not sure, at least check for that and check for some other, you know, is this kind of weird? Is it sent from a Gmail account? That kind of thing. Ransomware hasn't been in the news recently, but it has, you know, last year and the year before. The WannaCry virus from, I think, 2019 that encrypted, like, I think it was 10% of the world's digital everything, something like that, was a ransomware virus. So it would get onto your computer and encrypt everything and give you a message that says, hey, all this stuff is locked and you can't have it anymore because it's encrypted. If you pay us money in Bitcoin, even though that's not really the most secure option for the thieves, as we're starting to learn, then we'll give you the password. But until then, you can't have anything. And if you're a business, this is a big problem. If all of your grandkids' photos are on there, this is still a big problem. And really, there isn't typically another way aside from getting the decryption key. You're just kind of out of luck. You can walk away from the machine, factory reset it, if that's possible. Some of the malware does even better than that, and you can't actually use the machine. You can always buy another one. But your information is still what's at risk there. And surveillance is something we've sort of talked on, but that's just a pervasive threat. Knowing and understanding what information is being collected and stored, not only by the NSA, but by Facebook, by Google, by, you know, all these big tech giants that, as most of us would probably agree, don't have our best interests at heart, and maybe sometimes work actively against our cause. So we'll talk about digital valuables. Some of this is a little bit redundant, but it's good to focus on these as categories. Your private information, things like your address, photos of you, your shopping habits, all that stuff is a valuable tool to an adversary. And also, mostly none of their business, so it behooves us to protect against it. Online accounts, access to online accounts, especially email accounts, is very valuable. Because if you forget your password to your Facebook account, what do? You hit, I forgot my password. And it says, don't worry, we'll send you an email. Well, if someone else has access to that inbox too, they now have all the accounts that get those account reset emails back to you. And there are services online that have already crawled the internet, these are publicly available, where you can put in an email address, and it will then give you a list of all of the services that have signed up for an account using that email address. So then they've got a list. They've got a shopping list of, oh, well, I can go to eBay, that has credit card information usually in it already. I can go to Facebook, take over their Facebook, and run a smear campaign on them if we're being targeted in that way. Anywhere where you use that email address, especially if you use the same password, you're really up to date. Yes?
So,
yes.
Does that mean that your account is actually being loaded into, or is that
Yes and no. So in a lot of cases, your Facebook account can be taken over by means other than someone guessing the correct password and email address. And Facebook, I won't say they do a good job of helping someone out of that situation, but it's a common enough thing that there are resources that are available to a user to try to change that. Unfortunately, Facebook's not exactly a secure platform. That goes, you know, on the cybersecurity side for how easy it is to abuse the platform, as well as on the public side of, you know, just the operational security standpoint. So it's fairly easy if you follow the wrong link that someone sent you on Facebook from your Facebook account. It's fairly easy for someone to craft malware to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to that. Well done. That's on the last slide, but yes. Yes, yes. There are alternatives to Facebook. Almost everything's better than Facebook, but there are some good alternatives to Facebook. The other thing is stored data. So a lot of people have a hard drive at home. And you load your pictures and your documents onto that. And that's a good idea, especially if you don't leave it connected to the internet. That does give you a better level of security. One should also encrypt that device, because if someone comes in and steals that, you just plug it into a computer, they have everything. I would recommend an encryption software to encrypt that device. We'll get into that on the last slide, although I might not have mentioned it on there. I ran out of room, and it's a really text-heavy slide. The motto in the cybersecurity and in the IT world is always encrypt data at rest. So if it's not being utilized by a program currently, it should be encrypted. And a good website and a good company that uses web services should be doing that. A lot of our data breaches you see in the news are from companies that were not doing that. And sometimes it's whole unencrypted password lists. That's horrifying. Sometimes it's just, the password hashes were there, so that's the encrypted version of the password. Those are fairly easy to brute force if you want to spend the time doing it. And even just a username and password hash is worth money on the dark web. Usually in bulk and usually only a couple cents individually. But that's what criminals are looking for. Typically the hacker is looking for those account names and password hashes, because if you can dump 1,000 and it's a new dump and no one has seen these before, they haven't had time to patch them, people haven't been warned to change the password. A lot of people reuse passwords, please don't do that. We'll get to that in a second. But all of that's really valuable information. Yes and no, and that's in a later slide, but I'm glad you're thinking about that. A VPN is a good tool to have. It keeps your ISP from knowing your traffic, so that's a positive thing. But it's sort of a man-in-the-middle attack on yourself, if you know what that means. So all your traffic, for those who don't know, a VPN is a virtual private network. So all of your traffic goes from your router to someone else's server and then to the internet. And it's encrypted that whole way to the other server. So if you're on the coffee shop Wi-Fi, no one on that Wi-Fi network that could maybe have the technical knowledge to look at everything you're doing. Because if it's not in that little green lock, it's in plain text going over that network, anyone can see it. But this even includes your DNS request, which is what website are you going to, as what a VPN protects you against. So it can be a valuable tool, but if you're not paying for the service, you're probably the product, and they're probably just making a list that is now identified by a customer username and usually, maybe sometimes, payment credentials. There's not a lot of legal oversight in the VPN industry. It's kind of the Wild West. So there are a lot of VPN companies that will start up. There's no real great way to prove that they're doing what they say they're doing, unless you hack the company, which is kind of illegal typically, unless they've asked you to do that. And the non-above board ones just won't ask for that. So there's a few VPN recommendations later on. It can be a useful tool, but it's somewhat of a double-edged sword, because you are sending all of your traffic to one specific location that is known, that is tied to a specific identity. So if it's secure all the way through, it can be beneficial. But you really do have to trust that that guardian of all of your information has your best interests at heart, knowing that your data is very, very valuable, sold on the open market. Some of this, through some intelligent questions we've covered already, but the best approach to this is to use digital tools that are privacy respecting, or at least privacy conscious. So using a browser that is not Google Chrome, please stop. I know Chrome's super easy to use. It's very accessible. Google doesn't charge for any of their services because you're their product. They have the biggest, hands down, the biggest user base in the entire world, and they know it, and they leverage it, and they make some excellent products. They're streamlined, they work very well with other programs. It's a really great digital product that comes at the cost of Google knowing literally everything you know and probably everything you think. I don't think it's worth it. It's up to you to make that assessment. But I strongly recommend moving to other browsers. Firefox is a good one, Brave is a good one. Opera used to be a good one, but not so much anymore. They kind of turned to the dark side. Brave? Yeah. Brave is what I use personally. They built in, yeah. Yep. Yep. Yes. Brave like a lion. Yep, that works. It'll be spelled out in the last slide for you. And I'll make these available to Adam so you can send those out to us as well. So you can go through, because I know I'm going really fast. That's the next thing I was going to say. Well done. So there's a difference between a browser and a search engine. So they work hand in hand. The browser is the software you're using to access the internet. The search engine is sort of your index, what you're using to go and find the information. They can be sort of the same. In Firefox's case, they are, or they can be totally different. And also in Chrome's case, they are. They're all Google by default. So using one that respects a user's privacy, and again, I'll have a list of several at the end, is a good tool to have, because if you're using a privacy-conscious browser and then you're still defaulting to Google for all your searches, they still know your IP address, and it's not hard for them to correlate similar searches from a previous Google account and correlate, hey, this is the same account. There are algorithms that are good enough to do that. It's kind of scary. Private messaging, Signal, is really the gold standard right now. There are other options as well. Briar is actually technically more secure, but not as easy to use, and I believe only works on desktop. So, you know, it's not as accessible, but it's a good option. Private email services. I think everyone here, probably if you use the internet, has a Google account, a Gmail account. If you didn't know, Google reads all your emails and bases advertising profiles off of that. Like, they don't have a person going through and reading it, but they have an algorithm that goes through, searches keywords, indexes everything. They know what you're interested in because they read all of your, what I would consider to be private communications. Most people would consider an email to be, you know, it's a peer-to-peer, I'm sending you a letter just over the internet. Well, if you're using Google, it's I'm sending Google a letter that I asked them to send to you, but they're reading all of it. So I would consider it as secure as mail going to prison. They're going to read it all. They're going to know all of it. There are some great services. We'll get to two that are really, really privacy conscious and respecting of the user. They're not perfect. So if you want to go commit crimes and hide behind their service, they won't break the law for you. But they don't collect a lot of information that a lot of other email services do, and they don't do that on purpose. So that even if they did get a warrant or a subpoena, they'll give everything they have. It's just not very much because they never stored it. This is kind of a no-duh, but consider what you post publicly. Let's say hypothetically you're very politically involved and you went to a certain rally a couple years ago and then you Instagrammed yourself inside the state capitol. That was a dumb idea. Don't do that thing. But that goes for everything else too. And unfortunately, that means if you know, have your selfie at a political rally, that does identify you and target you in a certain way. That doesn't necessarily mean you shouldn't do that. We do certainly have the right to free speech, but there are security implications to what you make public and searchable to the entire world. So it's a two-edged sword, but yeah, don't film yourself in the Capitol if you broke in or do that thing, or really anything that would come close to that. I would go personally so far as to say if you're going to a political rally, particularly if it's a rally on a certain subject, not just a go raw Republicans, you probably should turn your phone off while you're there. It's not difficult, and it's known. I don't know if any of you went to the Second Amendment rally in Richmond a couple years ago. But you know, that was a great example of a very politically charged rally, very well attended. I don't think Richmond police or Capitol police ever confirmed and said they did, but there are devices that are available only to law enforcement until someone steals one or reverse engineers it, that mimic a cell tower stronger than the cell tower. So all the cell devices pair to it, and then it will boost your stuff out to what cell tower you need to go to. But they then collect all of that information. So they'll know your phone number. They'll know your location. They'll know any text message. I don't know. People know the difference between like sending an iMessage or digital message or SMS. SMS is a text message. It's what you typically would send as a text. That is plain text. So that is readable by anyone on that network. All of what you say, anyone who has access to the insides of that network can read that. That's why courts can go and subpoena text records. And most carriers keep that for 7 years. That's a freaking long time for all your texts to be stored. But, you know, I unfortunately know people who've gone to prison because their texts were subpoenaed that implicated them in a crime. They could have gotten around that, not saying go break the law, but they could have gotten around that if they had known that that was being logged, that what they were, the way they were communicating with people was not secure, and that there were more secure options. VPNs and Tor. So, you know, back to your point, a VPN can be a very useful tool, but you have to consider that, just like the cell site simulator that law enforcement uses, all of your digital information then goes siloed through this other endpoint and then out onto the internet. So whoever controls that endpoint does control and know all of your information. So if you're paying for it, you're less likely the product. There are some good services out there that are reputable. They hire people to test and hack into their stuff and verify that their stuff is working the way it's supposed to. And I can provide some more better curated lists that other people have generated that do a good job explaining what the pros and cons are for VPNs if you're interested. We'll get to that here in a second. Actually, we're pretty close to the end. Tor, for those that want to get really nerdy, is basically not necessarily a separate internet, but a separate way to use the internet. Tor is how you would access what's usually called the dark web, but you can use it to access the service web as well. Tor packages, Tor stands for the Onion Router, and it packages all of your requests to a server in three different layers of encryption, and then bounces it through three different endpoints before it hits the surface of the internet. So whatever your device is communicating with to Tor doesn't know where your traffic is going. It just knows to go that it came from you and to go to the next node. That middle node doesn't know who you are. It just knows this node gave me this and told me to send it to the exit node. And the exit node doesn't know your entry node. It only knows the middle node, and it knows where your traffic wanted to go to. So having all those three steps is incredibly slow and tedious to use, but it's probably the most secure way you could use the internet currently, because unless someone is controlling both the entry and the exit node simultaneously and timing your traffic by targeting a specific user, they're not ever going to know what device sent that information. So if you really want to get super nerdy, Tor is the way to go. The downside is it takes a long time for your traffic to go anywhere, because it's going four times as many places, and usually around the world a couple of times to do that.
What's a long time?
Oh, a long time is like 5 seconds. It's an absolute eternity for someone who's Gen Z. Actually, I've seen websites take as long as a minute or a minute and a half to load, depending on how heavy that website is.
I used to go through a calling service.
Right, yeah. It's on par with dial-up. Sometimes it can be a little bit slower. Some of it's contingent on the speed of your connection to the internet. If you have a really fast connection, it's going to be better than dial-up. But it's also dependent on the speed of the internet between all of those different nodes going out and coming back. And every time you click on something, it's doing that whole process again. So if you're accessing a website that has a lot of graphics, maybe has embedded videos, it's going to take it a very long time for that to make its way through the Onion network and then back to you and fully load the HTML onto your device. Talking about online accounts and, you know, Facebook and email stuff earlier, use a strong, unique passphrase, and I'm not saying password very intentionally, because a word like peanuts is not a password. It's very super easy for computers to crack now. So a phrase of multiple words, spaces are a great thing to include. A lot of programs that are designed to crack passwords are really, really bad at figuring out where spaces should be. So if you include a space or two in your passphrase, that's going to astronomically increase the security of your password. Obviously, the special characters, all that stuff. Unfortunately, a lot of websites, even though they might not publish, hey, there's a limit to how long your password can be, a lot of them limit how many characters you can have. Usually it's somewhere in about the 20 to 24 character length, which annoys me to no end because my average password is closer to 37 characters. And so then I have trouble using the typical password techniques that I use personally to add it to my websites. So it's kind of a pain. But
not a password with a space.
Well, if you're just putting a space at the end, that's probably not the best. One of the tools that I'll recommend here in a second, and we'll go there now, password manager. So this is usually an app on your phone. It is an eggs-in-one basket approach. It is secured by a password. So that master password does need to be very secure and probably not stored in any digital form anywhere. So maybe write it on a note and put it in your desk or in the document safe that you keep in your Kibbles and Bits box in your pantry. Where you can access it if you need to, but no one else is likely to find it. Because if you lose it, in most cases, you have locked yourself out of all your passwords. So that's not good. But that will allow you to generate computer-generated passwords that are very secure. It will also, most of them, I think probably all of them, will allow you to type in a password and it will rate it on how strong it is. So it will let you know based on what current algorithms are available for breaking passwords. It will let you know how secure the password you've created is. So I do strongly recommend a password manager because that allows you to realistically have a different password for every single online account that you have. And I know, especially when I was new to the internet 10 years ago, I was like, oh yeah, this is my password that I use, because I can remember it. And it's great for the end user, but one website gets hacked because they weren't following good protocol and encrypting data at rest, and that password that you use everywhere is now known. And it's linked to your email address that you're also probably using everywhere, but we'll get to that tool here in a second that allows you to use unique email addresses. Two-factor authentication, some people are aware of this, some people are not. That's just a second form of authenticating that you're trying to log in. The most common is an SMS push. So you get a text message that says, hey, this is your code. That is the least secure option because it is possible for someone to, if they're targeting you specifically, to do what's called SIM swapping and actually convince your cellular carrier that they are you and then start receiving all of your text messages, which then gets them all of your two-factor authentication pushes. So I recommend Duo is a good option. But there are a bunch of different two-factor authentication options that are digital. So you can have an app on your phone that when you log in, and you do have to manually set this up with most accounts. I try not to lose my voice. You do have to set it up individually with all accounts, so it's kind of a pain. But they will send it, they'll know which app it is. And so when you're logging in, it'll say, you know, send me an SMS push, send me a push to the app, or what have you. You can go a step farther and get a hardware two-factor authentication key. So that's what I have here. It looks like a thumb drive. And what this does is it is my second factor authentication. So if you try to log into my Google account, which I do still have, even though I don't use it all that much anymore, and you get my password right somehow, it's going to ask you to plug this specific individual device into the computer or hold it near the top of the mobile device, if it's a mobile device, and push the button. And if you don't have this, you can't get into the account, even if you have all the other credentials. So this, and there are a couple different companies that make these, but that is really as far as you can reasonably go. The government uses a similar system. A lot of government contractors, because of the legal requirements for security, use, this is YubiKey, actually use this specific company. Yes, YubiKey, I believe. And it should be on the last slide, hopefully spelled correctly. We'll find out in a second. Once you're in your accounts, it's really good idea to review your privacy settings. There are some things that you can manually turn off that will help you. Like Apple has a way to go into settings and tell it not to send you personalized ads, not to track your stuff for advertising purposes. You can just toggle that off, and Apple promises that they will stop. I don't know how much you trust Apple. It has been seen by people who have really done some good research into like their reports to the board and shareholders and stuff like that. They're not making a bunch of money off of selling user data. It would be very clear in their financials if they were. So it doesn't appear, at least to those that have done as good an audit as could reasonably be expected, that Apple is selling user data directly. They're definitely collecting it. They're definitely using it to improve their own products. But I think Apple's philosophy is more, we want everything so that we can be everything, sort of like Google kind of already is. And that's scary enough in itself, but at least they're not selling it to Google, I guess.
So do you have a Gmail account?
I have several Gmail accounts that I use for different things, although less and less. I don't use any of them for my primary communication. I usually use them in conjunction with, and I'm working on moving away from this, but I am still in process of securing my own digital stuff as well, because it takes a lot of time. I have two small kids and am building a house this year, and so I don't have a lot of time, but as I have time, I'm converting things over. And there are new tools becoming available every day that are better options, are more secure options, are more user-friendly options. So deleting unused accounts, this is something I honestly haven't done yet, but it's something that is part of your digital footprint. I've seen a lot of examples of people having been attacked digitally to gain access to an email account or something like that, because an old account that they didn't use for a long, long time was hacked into, and someone was communicating as them for long enough that they had enough of a background as this other digital identity that they were able to convince other accounts that they were that person. So if you're not using an account anymore for anything, it's best to log in and delete it. A lot of accounts make that intentionally obfuscated so that it's hard to do that, because they don't want you to go. I mean, a lot of the revenue is based, especially if they're selling to advertisers, on how many users they have. So a user going down by one is not a good thing. A great example of this in the news this week, the number of users of Netflix for the first time in its history went down instead of up. Their stock dropped 20%. So it's a really big deal to these companies to lose an account, and so they don't want to let you do it. But if you're not using the account anymore, instead of just letting it lie stagnant and open for attack, it's better that it not exist. That last part, using an aliased email service. So this would be a program that generates an email address that is not your email address that will automatically forward all of its emails back to your email address. So sort of like a VPN for email. So that you can sign up for your Netflix account with this one email address that you don't use anywhere else. and a password that you don't use anywhere else. And you'll still get the emails and can interact through your primary account. But if someone hacks Netflix, what they get is entirely useless because it's unique to that service and can't be sold anywhere else. And once that service has already been hacked, all of that's useless anyways. It's already known information. That'll be on the list here in a second. Home network, especially if you live in tighter neighborhoods. I used to live in a townhouse where my Wi-Fi was visible by at least 70 people because of its range. And I could see all my neighbors' Wi-Fi and know what their SSIDs were. It's not particularly difficult to hack Wi-Fi, even if you've done most of what you need to do to secure it. But especially if you haven't, it's very, very simple. I have some friends that do work in the cybersecurity industry professionally, and they kind of laugh at Wi-Fi passwords, and they're like, it doesn't matter, I'm into your Wi-Fi in 5 seconds typically. Which is terrifying, but the guys that know what they're doing, this particular gentleman used to work for Apple, working with, like, the new Tim Cook level worked for Apple, and now works for Amazon. So, you know, he's not exactly working for the best of companies, but they're hiring him because he really knows what he's doing. And paying him accordingly. Using a strong Wi-Fi passphrase, don't use peanuts. Same concept as earlier, use a long, unique passphrase. Change that regularly. It's a pain for IoT devices, but if it's what you use to log in and do your online banking, change that one regularly. Utilize a guest network if your router allows you to do that. So a lot of routers, when you log into settings, will allow you to broadcast two networks, or sometimes three, depending on the bandwidth. And you can assign different SSIDs to those and different passwords to those. So, you know, when you have guests over and say, hey, what's the Wi-Fi password? You give them your guest account. Typically, the firmware in your router will actually treat information differently coming through the guest network as it does coming through your primary network. So there's not usually an attack vector for someone from your guest network into your main network. Not always, technology is flawed, but it's designed to give you an extra layer of security there if you're sharing a Wi-Fi password. If you use IoT devices, IoT is Internet of Things. So it is your internet-connected toaster, your internet-connected smart speaker, your internet-connected doorbell, your internet-connected deadbolt lock. We didn't connect ours. I just put one on Paul's house. It's not connected. That's on purpose. But anything that's security cameras that you use Wi-Fi, all of those are vulnerable to attack. It's not hard to find internet articles from, I think, about a year ago where a lot of them were all hacked and used to create the world's biggest botnet ever and spam and attack different accounts. And people were finding out, oh yeah, my security cameras are apparently attacking a server in China. I don't want my security cameras attacking a server in China. I want them just being mine. But they're an easy attack vector. They're typically not secured on the firmware level as well. So if you're using them, your Amazon Alexa or any of that stuff, put it on a different network than you send your typical traffic through. The joke in the cybersecurity space is the S in IoT stands for security. There is no S. So individual devices, this is your laptop, your desktop, your Chromebook, your iPad, all of that stuff. Update your software regularly. If it has automatic updates, I do recommend that. There can be some downsides to that, but the upsides in almost every case far outweigh the downside to updating. Just last week, there were two new zero-day attacks that were published for all Apple devices. So if you didn't get the update since last week, you're vulnerable to those two attacks. A zero-day is an attack that hasn't been seen before, hasn't been patched against, and typically allows an attacker remote access to your device. Kind of a bad thing. Use a strong device passphrase. If you have an Android device and the default was like that little pattern, that has been proven scientifically by studies to be the absolute worst way to secure your device. It is the easiest thing for someone to glance over and replicate, and also the easiest for a program to try to guess based on the number of permutations that humans typically use. I recommend an alphanumeric password, and all of those devices will allow you to set one, even though it's not the default. So when I go and log into my iPhone, it gives me a keyboard, and I type in 37 characters worth of password to get into my iPhone. Is it a pain? Yes, it's a pain. I do use facial detection as well, because that allows me to bypass that. It's a double-edged sword. It's very convenient to just look at the phone, and it's unlocked now. Apple, at least, and I believe Android devices, typically build in a safe switch. If you turn your phone to emergency mode, it will back out of that. And same thing with fingerprint readers. It will back out of that and require the actual physical password the next time you log in. There's a legal implication for that, too. Your password in the U.S. is legally considered knowledge, and a warrant can't be issued to your knowledge, only to a physical thing, your property. So a password's not something that a court can compel you to produce, but your likeness or your fingerprint are considered more public information. So police can use your fingerprint by force to get into your device, or your face by force to get into your device when they wouldn't have been able to otherwise. Not that that's on most people's radar, but it's something to be aware of. A mugger can use your face or your fingerprint by force as well if they wanted to. If you're fast enough, I guess, you can put it in emergency mode. But it's a good thing to be aware of, that you know, anything that makes something more convenient makes you less secure. That back to the home security side, that's always a spectrum. There is easy to use, and there's secure. And it's up to you to decide where on that spectrum you want each individual thing to be. Fort Knox is a very inconvenient place to be, but it's very secure. Most people wouldn't want to live in Fort Knox, but you also don't want to live in a park where everyone can see all of your everything. So there's a happy medium to be had there, and it's sort of incumbent on the individual to decide where that is and cognitively put themselves there. So that's sort of what I'm hoping to get people to with this presentation. Yes, go ahead. Yes.
Is there anything you think you don't want to do with 5G or whatever you're saying? Do you want things that are going to be practical?
So that's an interesting rabbit hole to go down, which I'm happy to do. 5G is a hardware as well as a software. So if your phone doesn't have a 5G antenna, it can't 5G. And even if you have an update that says, oh, supports 5G, it doesn't do anything to your device if you don't have a 5G antenna built in. And you will probably know if you do, because right now it's, one, more expensive to buy that because it's an emerging technology, and two, it's advertised because a lot of cell phone providers are like, hey, get the latest greatest, because most people want the latest and greatest, so they're really pushing, hey, buy your 5G enabled devices. So if you don't have a 5G antenna in your device, and unless you bought an iPhone 12 or later, you don't have one. Android, it's a little bit muddier. You can look up your device's specs. I just don't know them off the top of my head, because there are like 11 different iPhones in use and 113 different Android devices in use in the American market, and I just don't know all of them. But yeah, if you see 5G in the security update or the software update readout, unless you have a 5G antenna, it doesn't change anything. See, what was I? Review your device security settings. I think I might have already said that. Going into Apple or Android or whatever you have, or Windows. Windows 11 is actually really notorious for scraping a lot of information that previous Windows devices used to do. Some of it you can turn off, some of it you can't. Some of it you can turn off by downloading third-party programs that claim to turn it off. That's a whole nother bucket of worms to get into, whether or not you trust the third-party developer or not is an interesting proposition. It just gets kind of sticky. If you're really super worried about it and don't mind a little bit of inconvenience, the Linux operating system is actually fairly user-friendly now, and works with most things but not all, and is typically a better option for a privacy or security mindset. But then there are 500 different operating systems that are Linux, so that's probably a 5-hour presentation in and of itself.
In the episode, would you like to name two or three?
There's actually a tab in settings for privacy. I would just scroll what's under there. Privacy and location are the two that I would focus on. Although I think they're cross-linked in Apple's operating system, so that if you're viewing privacy, you should also be viewing location. I typically am. It depends on... in my mind, there's no way to keep your cell phone's operating system from knowing your location, and there's no way to keep your cellular provider from knowing your location. That's just not... Like, turn your device off? Probably. But when you turn your phone off, do you know that it's off? And I'm not trying to get super, super paranoid, but unless you disconnected the battery, which you can't do in 99% of phones these days without taking it apart, it on some base level, it's still operating. And in the case of most the newer Android operating systems and all of Apple, their source code isn't open source. So we don't have a way to verify that your phone is all the way off, except for trusting Apple or trusting, in Android's case, Google, that it's indeed off. Now you could get, if you're worried about that, you can get a Faraday bag to put your phone into. And that will block all sort of radio signals. Faraday bag, F-A-R-A-D-A-Y, I believe, named after Michael Faraday. So if you're paranoid to that level, I don't own one yet, but I do plan on getting one, actually.
On YouTube, there's a Canadian program called Market.
Okay.
A marketplace. And they do documentaries on a lot of things. Two spirits. One were on apps, mm-hmm. especially free apps, mm-hmm. and then the other one was on. The whole point is screw.
Basically, yes. That's an accurate
but
concise.
Get rid of all your apps on your phone. Yeah. Never set the free mm-hmm. app.
Yeah. If you don't use it regularly, I wouldn't keep your apps.
So they did something. They showed people, mm-hmm.
A lot of, so with security cameras, I'm glad you brought that up because I didn't put it in here. If you buy security cameras that are internet connected, particularly off-brand ones, in a lot of cases, they are publicly accessible. So like if you know that IP address, you can go from just type it into a browser and you're looking at the live feed. There's no password.
And that's what they did. They went into people's homes, yep. they set up a meeting, they knocked on the door, and they showed them what they were doing. But they also set up an app. Like, when you give an app and it's like, do you agree to the terms?
Yeah.
Like 400 pages, and nobody ever just says, yes, I agree.
Nope.
In that, you've given someone's definition.
Yep.
It's unbelievable.
Yep.
And they set up an app, and people on the street.
Oh, yeah, just like
sure. They are taking pictures of you while you're speaking to someone.
They can. So, on that note, my cell phone case, you'll notice what you can't see in this cell phone case, and that's my camera. So I intentionally got a case that covers the camera. So unless I want to take a picture, and then I can go take a picture. Same thing. Now, I haven't got one for the front because with the facial recognition, there's an IR blaster that if you cover the facial recognition, doesn't work anymore. There used to be someone producing a product that covered only the camera and left the sensors exposed. Pros and cons to that because you can still sort of map things with that if you wanted to. But it's better than nothing.
All the people who work for, these guys are crazy.
Yep.
Their cell phone is in
your
bedroom. It's locked up and it's out.
Yeah.
No smart TV, no Alexa,
yeah.
No this,
yep.
No that.
The amount of information that, and you can go, especially if it's a Google device, you can actually go to your Google account and download all the data they have on you. It's publicly available. It's pages and pages and pages long. And they don't make it easy to read because they don't want you to, but it's there. So moving along to my definitely more than 20 minutes. trying to talk fast. There's a lot here. We've covered a lot of this already. Back up your devices regularly, so all your photos, all that stuff, put it on that hard drive that you keep. If you can, store backups in more than one location. So that way, if your house burns down, you didn't lose your hard drive, it's somewhere else, and those are both simultaneous. That takes effort to do, though, because you then have to sync up multiple physical locations when you do a backup. So you do have to be really proactive about that in order to do that. And that may be a case where you put all of your backups in one place, and then you manually back up certain sensitive information to an offsite location as well. But it's good to not have all your eggs in one basket physically. Encrypt your data to storage devices while they're not in use, so that when you plug it in, you have to open a program. It's not in the final slide. Veracrypt is an open source, free to use program that is well respected by the privacy community. Enables you. It's not very technically easy to use, but there are tutorials on the internet for it. Allows you to encrypt a hard drive so that when you plug it in, you'll have to open Veracrypt on your computer, mount that hard drive to Veracrypt, and then type in your password before you can view any of the information on it. One takeaway, that's a great question. Sign up for a Google account. I say that very hypocritically because I have Google accounts, but really getting Google out of your life is a huge step in that direction. Cloud storage can be a great option, but going back to phrases in the IT community, there is no cloud, there's just someone else's computer. So what do you plan on doing? Notably with Apple, if you use iCloud Backup, Apple does encrypt that information on their servers, but they retain the encryption key. So, back to maybe an obscure reference, but law enforcement can send a warrant to Apple and say, we want all the things off this phone. And Apple goes, yeah, here's their backup. We unencrypted it for you because we have the key. Go ahead.
I was going to say, one thing is to see Bradley's movie, which was military, and he said that we have all switched to using Mint. Because Verizon and AT&T, all those other carriers have access to your
computer. Yeah. I will need to look into that. I know Cricket actually is known for being a great one as well. It is, yeah. Yeah, I use a similar service. Was it Visible? But when I asked their tech support people, what's your privacy policy? They didn't know or wouldn't tell me. It's hard to know which over text. I just assume if it's going through Verizon's network, Verizon does do some tracking of it. But if you're not a Verizon customer, it's still more obfuscated as to the individual. So the more steps you can put between you and the ISP, the better. So this bottom one, and this is the last point. But if you really, really want to get nerdy, you can maintain your own private server. It worked out pretty well for Hillary Clinton. It can work out pretty well for you. It worked. It did. Yes, go ahead.
And then later in the afternoon, you go on YouTube or wherever you want, and you can get an advertisement for what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I mean, a lot.
Yeah, more than could be explained by coincidence.
So,
yeah.
Your phone's off, and I'm talking about the phone.
All right. So this is my last slide. These are just the tools and solutions. Hey, it actually did load right. So Firefox is a good option as far as a browser to use. Brave is what I use personally. Brave actually includes an option to have a private tab that defaults to Tor network. So it will do the Tor networking for you on that tab. You will notice a speed difference if you use that. The other thing with Tor is it does tend to break websites. Because Tor is used by malicious parties, because it obscures you really well, a lot of websites either don't allow you to access them, or require you to solve a CAPTCHA or a, you know, select all the images here with the bicycle type thing before you can access like the New York Times or something fairly innocuous that you would normally be able to just use the service web and go to. So you do take a hit on usability, but you do get a benefit in privacy. It's moving that slide between convenience and security a little bit farther towards security and less away from convenience. Tor is there. You can get a browser that is just Tor, and that's the more secure way to do it. If you want to get into that, do some research first, but that can be an option. DuckDuckGo was mentioned as a good search engine. That is actually what I use personally as well. Start page is Google results, but anonymized, so Google doesn't know who's making the request, so they're not tying it to an advertising profile. DuckDuckGo actually does their own, from what I understand, does their own web crawling and actually offers you results based on that. So, and then Quant or Qwant, I'm not sure how they pronounce it. I haven't used that one personally, but it is fairly respected in the privacy community and security community online. I just haven't had much experience with it. Bitwarden is a password manager. Bitwarden, in my opinion, is the best option because it allows you to, they do have like a cloud storage option, which is secure, and they tell you when you set up your password, if you lose this, we can't help you. We don't have it, we can't unencrypt your stuff. If you lose it, you're on your own, don't lose it. Some other password managers have a recovery option. And in this case, recovery means we can get to it. So Bitwarden's a great option. You can actually self-host Bitwarden on your own server. If you're that much of a nerd, you can do that thing. So two-factor authentication, obviously there's SMS 2FA, that's a text message you get. It's better than not having any, but it's the worst of all the options. Duo is a great service. The YubiKey, which I did spell incorrectly, it's with a Y, is the hardware version, and there are a couple other competitors to them that are probably all comparable. ProtonMail is an email service that is free at a certain level. A lot of these services use what's called a freemium payment system. So they'll have a base level of service that is accessible to anyone. Bitwarden is this way as well. And then a premium service that you can pay for, and that's how they fund their company. And it's usually something as little as, I think Bitwarden is $7 a year. So it's a pittance, but it enables you to have multiple accounts. So it's like, I think they call it a family plan, actually. So it enables you to have multiple accounts to log in, and I think that's how you get the 2FA on Bitwarden as well. So ProtonMail has a free service as well as paid tiers. They are based in Switzerland, and they're very secure, privacy-conscious email service. They don't read your emails. They can't read your emails. They don't store your IP addresses unless you're actively logged in, because they would need to know it in order to give you your mail. They also allow you to encrypt your emails. So you can send a password-protected email to someone that's not on an encrypted service. If you're sending an email on ProtonMail to another ProtonMail account, it is intimate encrypted by default. No one but those two end users can read that message. If you send it to someone with a Google account, obviously they have to be able to read it, so it is unencrypted there. But you can password encrypt it, so they will need to put in a password for it. Then you do have to communicate a password to that person so they can read your email, but that also means that while they have it unencrypted, when they log back out, it re-encrypts. So Google's not going to be able to troll through and read that unless they're reading it while they have it open. So it does give you another level of privacy. You can also send self-deleting messages on a timer. So if you want to send an email that deletes itself 20 minutes after you sent it, or after it's read, you can send that, and then that information just disappears. Signal, okay, we got that later on. Signal also allows you to send self-deleting messages and things like that, so that they disappear. Tutanota is comparable to ProtonMail. They're a secure, privacy-conscious email provider with a free and also premium subscription services. Simple Login is what I was talking about earlier. That's a program that allows you to link it with an email address and then use it to create aliased email addresses that feed back to it. So when you're logging in for, or you're signing up for an account, you can give it an email address that only goes back to you and it's unique to that account, so you're not spamming your email address across of everything. Signal, we talked about private messaging. If there's one takeaway, I would say start using Signal and stop using text. And the more people move over to Signal, the fewer people, the easier it is to get that critical mass of people that are using Signal natively. Signal does require your cell phone number to link to your account. That's the only form of identification that they do require. But their thought process is, in replacing text messaging, they do need to be able to have some crossover between text messaging and an identity to send the emails to. So they use a phone number instead of a name or email address. They don't require anything. They just say, give us your phone number, use your phone number, link to that account. Go ahead. Telegram is a decent option, but not as good as Signal. Is it Telegram that's owned by Facebook? No, that's. Oh, that's right. You know, those trust ruling characters. I say that sarcastically. I'm not 100%. Signal is a private entity. I don't know specifically who owns it, but. I'm very curious how Signal plans on being that, because they do require the internet to work. If everything goes dark, talk to your local ham operator. really, that's who I would go to for comms. Because all of these services do require a working internet. Which is resilient long-term, but also fragile short-term. It's not hard for a nation-state to disrupt it and make things stop working, but it's also fairly resilient in that it will probably start working fairly soon, because there's a lot of people making a lot of money based on it working, and we'll invest a lot of resources into making it work again. Let's see. Proton VPN. Proton Mail actually has a VPN service that they run as well. They are really the only free VPN service that I could begrudgingly recommend. They do pay people to attack and assess their security on that. The free version, they're a great example of a freemium service. The free version of Proton VPN gives you like 5 servers and a much slower data rate than most people, than most millennials would find acceptable. Molvad is a highly rated VPN service. IVPN are both very highly rated, trusted VPN services. Those are both paid services, so you are going to have to pay them something every month.
You're supposed to be running here every 7 months.
Oh.
So I probably should have addressed.
Sorry.
If we can wrap up.
Yes. Well, I'll read the last line and then I'll be done. The last slide is actually, so a de-Googled phone, you've asked me about this before. Is a phone that uses an operating system that isn't Apple and isn't Google. It's more complicated than that, but it essentially takes all of your device's ecosystem out of the hands of the tech giants. It does mean you're kind of responsible for sourcing your own information, sourcing your own apps, although there are marketplaces for that are theoretically trustworthy and should be secure, but it's a nerd solution. I wouldn't recommend it for most people, but it's an option. I was going to open it up for some questions and answers, but we've already done that. So, yeah.